You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need milk for Zoe and a cold brew for yourself, King Soopers delivery will get you just what you need in as little as 30 minutes. Open the King Soopers app and start your cart, whatever the cart. Whenever, King Soopers, fresh for everyone. Delivery times not guaranteed. Restrictions may apply. See site for details.
When you're a Boost member, you get free delivery, double fuel points, and lots more. Sign up at kingsoopers.com/boost.
Welcome back to the Kickabout on the Blue Room. We're going to talk about football. We're going to talk a bit about Everton, but unfortunately, we have to go to some pretty dark places as you all join us in working through, I don't know, we're up the stages of grief, I think, is what we're all kind of just ploughing through day to day. Joined also by Keith Tomlin this week, who is joining us in moving, hopefully, from anger and bargaining to just sheer acceptance. Keith, I know that when we were in Rigby's at the weekend doing the post-match, I think we all kind of tried to get to that position very quickly in terms of just knowing what Everton have done to us in the past and what they were doing to us at the time. But I think the most shocking element of my weekend, mate, is when you messaged me at 3:30 on Sunday morning to ask me if you could still have my tickets from Man City away. And if there was a definition of clinical insanity, I think that would have summarised it very quickly. But it sounds like you've had an eventful weekend, mate.
We're absolutely tapped, aren't we? We're just gone in the head. As a species, we need studying by clinical psychologists because we're not all there. We talk about the stages of grief. I think Rigby's was denial because we were still laughing about it quite a bit, which we've been chastised for on Twitter because we weren't quite angry enough about Everton.
I
got home at 9:30 in the morning on Sunday after the game. So I managed to knock out all five stages of grief before I'd even got to my bed, which is very cathartic, I will say. But at my age now, it's getting harder and harder to recover from behaviour like that. So I spent the next 2 days absolutely written off. It wasn't very good, was it? I mean, like, what more can you say? They just fully quit. They got to a position where they should have gone on and been professional and seen that game out. Like, when did we scored on something like, was it 73 minutes? We scored the second goal.
Yep.
So you're looking at 17 minutes plus injury, 20 minutes to see out a game against a team that, let's be brutally honest, this season have been a bin fire.
Yeah.
And like, our home form, West Ham aside, has been pretty good. We should have seen that game out.
Yeah.
Didn't even need to score another goal. Just be competent on the ball and don't give them anything. And we gave them everything. We just gave them the world. Just go on, do what you want, lads. We're not going to stop us. You. So, yeah.
So
I don't know. We'll just...
I was going to say, Rob, you can obviously tell from where we kind of went after the game in terms of an emotional point of view. And I think so often, I think for people who go to the game regularly, it you kind of build up that protective layer after seeing these things happen so many times. I know we've all had a few days now to digest this and think about where we are on the just anger, apathy scale. And the harsh reality of Premier League football is that the games will come thick and fast, and you haven't really got the time to dwell on this for too long. But certainly during the game and in the immediate aftermath, Rob, watching from afar, was the pain of how raw and surprising this result very much there, or is there just an eternal ability of Everton to take themselves to the shocking lows that we managed to strive to find consistently? Because I don't know about you, mate, but nothing surprises me about this football team anymore. And as Keith referenced earlier on, we got a little bit of stick at the weekend for being semi-jovial about this in the pub after the game when we were doing the post-match. But I don't know. I think if you strip away the seriousness of how poor Everton can be as a football team, you're obliged to live a much happier life. Would you go along with that?
I mean, as far as last weekend goes, I you know, just kind of continuing on from the theme of last week, I would have to say that the final two episodes of Midnight Mass really were the payoff that I was hoping for.
No.
It really was one of those types of series where you get beyond kind of the deeper subject matter of it, and you're hoping that kind of the entertainment horror, like, how is this all going to wrap up sort of thing works out. And it did. And it really kind of renewed my faith, frankly, on some level about the way in which people can kind of view death and view bad things happening to them and so on. So
Rob Vera is trying everything in his power to not talk about Everton and football this week, and I absolutely am not going to let it happen on my watch. Rob, we have to own this.
You're breaking up, Mark. You're breaking up.
Nope.
If you
read Twitter at all, Rob, which I know that you do, we are all part of this problem. So,
are we now? I'm not part of this problem.
You have to own the choice that you have made. And do you know what? I'm not going to repeat the incredible phrase that Matt Flusk used in the pub to describe your bizarre affinity for this football club. But the general summary of it was that most of us over here have been born into this through bloodline, but you, my friend, you picked this life. I have, in terms of not having sympathy for people, you are top of my list right now.
Type that into the chat, because I really want to see this word, and I may not be able to say it on this podcast, but I would like to see it. I mean, there's a lot of language is not really something I'm too concerned about on this podcast, because we put that little magical E next to every episode, and then I don't ever have to deal with the consequences at that point, except for people who complain sometimes that the profanity is unprofessional at times. And I thought to myself, A, I'm not a professional at this. B, I don't really know how you talk about Everton on any sort of consistent basis without using profanity. Those who can and those who do have a restraint level that I simply do not possess. While we're live on this, live recording this, I want to see if I, so is someone going to put it in there? Okay. You put it in this chat. Okay. I was looking for the WhatsApp chat. So I'm reading. I mean, yeah, I'm a junkie. I don't know that junkie. I think it was the full analogy there you didn't want to use some were born into this and I chose it. So, well, let me start with one thing that you said that really intrigues me, because I have been thinking about some of the reaction from the Twitter Park End crowd about you guys not caring enough or taking this all seriously enough. And I'm talking to all of you who are listening, which I guess in theory, that's what a podcast does functionally. But we support, like the collective we, all of us who are a part of the Blue Room, all of us who are listening to podcasts like this, we collectively support a very poor football club. Okay. I mean, let's just say that you can talk all you want. I get we historically, our history stands up to anyone's. We have great things that as a club we stand for, quote unquote, in terms of our outlook, towards the greater world and, you know, those who are struggling and the community and taking care of our neighbors and a lot of really good things that I can sort of hang my hat on. But you know, if you've ever supported if you've ever supported a team in any sport that was really good, and I think most of us probably at one time or another have supported some team that was pretty good or that won a title in something. Okay. You never really think about the fan bases that are part of that same competition who are always kind of down and always suffering. You know, they are the fodder, if you will. They are the ones who are there to be the sacrificial lamb to that joy that you are extracting from your great side. You know, I have friends who support City and who support United, and I think about the fact that it must be nice to just sort of wake up and never really consider what actual struggle is like, or what actual, you know, adversity is like, or just kind of persistent soul crushing mediocrity every year, year after year, over and over again, and over and over again, and to still pay for the privilege to witness it. We are one of those groups. We support a mediocre football side. And I say mediocre pretty kindly. I mean, I think that you can say, if you look at the last, 20 years of Everton Football Club, we've had one pretty cool high of like making a Cinderella run to a Champions League spot back in 2004-05. Other than that, it's been, you know, hey, top eight finishes a bit, but then 12th and middle, we're mid table and we're just not very good. Our parents or our grandparents supported good Everton sides. Hey, my dad was alive and can recall every single moment of Super Bowl III when the New York Jets won the NFL title. The New York Jets won a Super Bowl. And if you know anything about the NFL, you realize how absurd it is to think about the New York Jets winning anything. So I can assure you that we just happen to be fans of a bad team. And so for anyone to tell us that we can't laugh about this or that we can't comfort ourselves with gallows humor, I mean, fuck off, seriously. Like that's all we've got at this point. I am now, don't get me wrong. When this particular side is fit, when we have Calvert-Lewin firing, when we have Yerry Mina with functioning hamstrings, when we have Richarlison and you know, everyone play, we're actually a team that when you add Townsend and Gray in and Koure and Allen doing their thing, we're actually a side that I still stand behind this notion that you can get behind them. But I think what we saw over the past weekend was another reminder of just how thinly, like right below that thin surface of potential, I don't know, that thin surface or thin veneer of like potential competency and a group of guys that you can sort of get behind, lie a bunch of squad players that absolutely suck. They suck as professionals. They suck as teammates. They are people who I saw way too many of them half-ass it for the last couple of goals that Watford scored. There seemed to be a complete resignation. And I'll just go ahead and say this because, you know, you're not supposed to say this about professional athletes or ever accuse them of it, but there were several players, and you know who they are, who absolutely quit on Saturday. And to do so and to capitulate in the manner that they did is just a reminder of how much cancer there still is that's left at this club. And the problem is that we get close, but we never quite get rid of the whole tumor. You know, we always seem to get a new manager in who comes in as a surgeon, who takes some of that tumor out, and they get 80% of it out. But man, that 20%, boy, it just holds on and it holds on and it continues to make the body sick. And it never allows us to fully, you know, get past things like curses and, you know, all the things that we lament as Everton supporters. So I this whole podcast, the point of this entire podcast, the entire reason Kickabout exists is so that we could talk about other things besides Everton, because Everton require that. To support Everton is to require the ability to laugh at pain. And if you can't laugh at sports pain, and you call yourself an Everton supporter, then I think that you are going to meet an early death, because that is just going to eat you alive if you can't laugh at how ridiculous they are and how ridiculous it is that you, sports fan, you, Everton supporter, actually spend money, spend part of your emotional capital, spend your time, and tell your children that they should do the same generation after generation to support this shit show at Goodison Park. And yet, as much as you guys make the point about the fact that I chose this, I guess I did choose this 17 years ago. And if I felt like there was any credible possible way for me to get out of it, I would, but I can't. And so I won't. I'm stuck here with all of you because I still love you all, despite the fact that, you know, and frankly, we are the ones whose love for one another throughout this misery is the only thing that keeps us going. Because as much as we love Everton, Everton doesn't love us back, and it becomes more painfully apparent with every passing week.
Keith, I think what Rob said there about supporting I won't say bad. We're an underperforming football club on the brink of greatness in the next few years. We would all hope.
Hey, Mark, can I ask this? Can I just point this out? Underperforming suggests that at some point recently we performed, and I just don't know that beyond a six-game stretch here or there that we've really, six or seven-game stretch here or there. When is this time we've performed? I'm just curious.
Until you mention the actual calendar year of this achievement, I was quite happy to dine out on us qualifying for a Champions League qualifying game. But now that you make me realize that was 17 long years ago, I'm not sure it stretches to relevance anymore. But I think that, do you know what? Supporting a bad sporting institution is all of those words that we've said. It's jovial, it's comical at times. But the problem with doing that with Everton at the moment is that we've actively tried, both from a sporting point of view and primarily from a financial point of view. And do you know what? I'll never be able to quote the figure of what we've actually spent in the last God knows how many years under Farhad Moshiri. But that attracts pain when you go to the levels that we have done to actually improve and still manage to have a squad that we have, still manage to churn out the style of performances that we have. And I think, Keith, the one word that will eternally haunt this football club is mentality. And it's one that I think we've always managed to try and steer away from in general conversation, in conversation on these podcasts, because I think it's a very easy thing to do to point at a sportsman or a sports team and say, well, you're not winning anything, so your mentality is very bad, when quite often, simply from an Everton point of view, the calibre of footballer is simply not there. But I think Rob touched on an important point there, and he said, well, when you strip away people like Calvert-Lewin and you strip away people like Richarlison, clearly this football squad is flawed and the drop-off in quality is enormous. That's not what disappointed me at the weekend. I think that the thing that really got to me was all of the things we've said about the lack of professionalism. And in the same way that you take a couple of great players out of this squad and it becomes absolutely underpants, what happened at the weekend is that we went through, what was it, a 4 or 5 minute spell of absolute chaos. And the ability to cope with that situation was akin to the ability of a football squad not being able to cope without its best couple of players. A couple of bad things happened. They led to goals. Yes, Josh King rubbed our faces in it, which we all knew was going to happen. And the backbone of the team just totally disintegrated. I think that's, under Carlo Ancelotti, I thought that was going to be the main thing that he brought into this football club. We're not going to be able to go out and attract the world's best players and keep them here for any great deal of time. Yes, we saw people like James Rodriguez come in, and it was all lovely for a spell of time. But the idea of going out and getting someone like Carlo Ancelotti and adapting to a philosophy that someone who's been there and done it at the top level of European football was going to bring us is that we don't shit ourselves when we concede an equaliser with 10 minutes left. And God forbid, if we do go 3-2 down and there is 7 or 8 minutes left, we don't press the self-destruct button and lead to an eternal chaos, which, again, Everton seem to always be able to capture. But is that the main thing that you take away from that? And I appreciate that you weren't there for the last 45 minutes of the game, but was that your takeaway? Or are you looking back at that game and picking out football and technicalities and thinking, well, we are a Calvert-Lewin or we are a fully fit Richarlison away from that not happening?
It's a lot to unpick, isn't it? Do you know what?
Mark's famous 10-minute questions are almost as famous as my 8-minute questions.
It's not even that. It's just Everton. Like, I've been trying to figure Everton out for a long time.
Football managers have as well, mate.
I don't think I'm anywhere near an answer. I just there's nothing immediately obvious that strikes you of why this keeps happening to us. I mean, we got Carlo Ancelotti, one of the best managers in world football, and we were getting absolutely leathered at home by teams like Leeds and Burnley. Right, so we've gone to Rafael Benitez, who's supposed to be one of the most like tactically astute, organized managers in world football. And we shipped 4 goals in 15 minutes against, like, bottom of the table Watford. You go back to, like, managers before that, and, like, where do you start to unpick Everton's issues? And it's basically my simple solution is to just knock it all on the head and focus on the charity, because Everton in the community is a great thing that they do very well, and they have tremendous success with. So let's just do that and leave the football, because we're clearly not cut out for it. You were saying about, like, you don't want to talk about the figure that we've spent under Mashiri, so we're going to avoid actual numbers. But I mean, this might be a bit niche for Rob, being from overseas. Do you remember Michael Carroll a few years ago won the lottery? He was a bin man from Norwich or Norfolk, somewhere in Norfolk, right?
Yeah.
He won the lottery, and clearly this man was the most ill-equipped man to ever win the lottery. He won something like £8 million, and he bought himself like a country mansion with a beautiful stately home, promptly dug up the back garden and turned it into a dirt track. He spent, like, I remember reading interviews, and he was spending something like 10 grand on cocaine a weekend.
Wow.
Right? He won £8 million on the lottery, and he was skint within sort of 5 years, right? That's Everton. We should never have got a billionaire owner, because we are not equipped for it, right? We were happy when we were poor. We were poor, but we were happy. Do you know what I mean? We never wanted for anything. We always sort of trundled along and did all right, and we were never in any danger.
I'd go as far as saying we were happy, but
it wasn't bad. The latter years under David Moyes, where we were constantly, like, we had a little European run every season, and we'd maybe have a cup run here and there, and like, we'd win some games, and we'd look all right.
Yeah.
And we'd sort of finish in that sixth, seventh position. And we never really had aspirations of doing much more, but we knew nothing worse was going to happen. And then along came Farhad, and we all went, right, this is it. This is our moment. We're gonna break the big time. And then we promptly shit the bed. Like, and not just shit the bed. We shit the bed and then rolled around in it for a while before calling for mum to come in and look at us lying there in our bed, all covered in shit. That's what Everton did when they were giving money. And I just, like,
we were like Spud trying to hide all the shit in our sheets from his girlfriend's parents, and then it just flying across the room right into their breakfast and onto their faces.
And everyone was quoted. And I think, like, honestly, we just need to give up on aspirations of Everton ever doing anything, except that, like what Les said in the group chat the other day, the 80s was not, like, the start of something. The 80s was an anomaly. Everton got lucky and touched on, like, a few hardworking players with a bit of talent and a manager who knew what he was doing when he, like, before he went off to Spain, and then just, like, the same fella didn't come back. We just need to we've got all this. Oh, yeah, we've the fourth most successful team in English history and stuff. That was a fluke rather than, like, any sign of us actually deserving to be there.
Mm.
And we should just leave it to other people and just go.
And I'm always loath to ask this question, because no matter how much I care, no matter how many times I come over for matches, no matter how many friends I have there, I am still always going to be an outsider. Like, I know that. Like, I'm as inside as an outsider can be, but I am an outsider. I wonder, and maybe you guys can answer this better than I could, but is the problem that we collectively have this sense of entitlement because of our history? Like, we deserve to get, quote, get back to this place. This place that almost everyone who says it wasn't even alive to actually see. These are all YouTube clips and, big coffee table books about Everton that tell me how great this club once was. And I know that we were. And I actually find that to be one of the most kind of beautiful things about the club, is that we have all of this great history. But, you know, like, I know someone would be listening to this and say, well, what's the point if you don't expect to win? And maybe that's a good question. Like, what's the point of following and supporting a club if there's no realistic chance to actually, you know, win or to achieve, the highest whatever. And again, I know we've kind of reduced our expectations down to, well, maybe we can win the League Cup sometime, or if we can win the FA Cup sometime. And I would love that. But I don't know where the entitlement comes from. Is that something that's been passed down because of all the, I guess, just because of the previous success? And to Keith's point, like, how much is that entitlement just making us miserable? Like, I think before, to his point about the later years of Moyes, like, man, that team that had Fellaini in at the end, where we were just, when we were going to, like you said, Europe, and we would joke about having to play like medalist Kharkiv or whatever in the Ukraine on a Thursday night on some really bad stream, and talking about the fact that, you know, the low rent UEFA Cup or Europa League was what it was. But I do remember at least liking them. I didn't like when they shitted in big games. I didn't like it when we didn't win trophies. I didn't like Moyes kind of just watering down our expectations to the point of misery at times. So I don't want to paint the past as this utopian place that it wasn't. But we all thought that, hey, look how much we do without means. If we had means, imagine what we could do. And the problem is that the playing field that we're on has only become more advantageous to the rich. It has only become, and when I say rich, like, we're rich in terms of the top 25, 30 clubs in the world, but we are, you know, by contrast, very, you know, we're very middle of the road compared to the clubs that we play in a competition with in England. And so I just wonder if our own expectations don't really match any kind of reality based on, you know, any kind of reality on the ground, if you will, right? Like, I don't know, like, what is it? We have an owner that's a billionaire, but yet he's not really as rich as the Chelsea owners. He's not as rich as the City owners, or now the Newcastle owners, or what have you. And so We don't play in a league that has any kind of rules about financial, equity or any of those things. And so I just wonder where it comes from. Why do we make ourselves so miserable? But maybe then what's the alternative, Keith, to ask, your question back to you? I don't think we can technically just go back to those old days, because if the choice is between being, this or being Burnley or something, like, I don't want to be Burnley either. I think the problem is, I don't know what I want us to be. Like, I can't look at a single side in this league and say, I wish we were more like them and feel like it's even realistic. Maybe Leicester, maybe, but I just don't think it's really, it doesn't feel realistic, even if it is realistic on paper for some reason. It just doesn't feel realistic.
But in terms of sporting pedigree, Rob, you said you don't want to be a Burnley. I mean, neither do I, but what's the difference? What have we got now that a club like a Burnley haven't, or, any one of these run-of-the-mill, middle-of-the-league, Premier League clubs? Because to answer your bigger question in terms of where does this entitlement come from, well, me as a 33-year-old Everton fan, I don't know. I wish I knew. I would love to feel the resentment towards this club that I'm sure some older fans who have actually seen us be relevant quite rightly have. And to be honest, that success in the 80s, for some people, I'm not saying for everyone who was lucky enough to witness that, but it will absolutely be a curse, and I absolutely feel sorry for those people. But I've supported a very bad Everton side for my entire life, so the sense of expectation, mm-hmm. Of expectation for a football team is just simply not there. But I think that the point that you've raised with Burnley is one that I think a lot of Everton fans that certainly I speak to is one that we're all coming to terms with, is that we're just one of the others. That's essentially just all we are now. I mean, we've referenced 2004, we've referenced the 80s. The last time we've done anything of real note, apart from a one-off 1995 FA Cup win, was 35 years ago. 35 years. I mean, this Premier League changes in massive cyclical fashion. Every, 7 or 8 years, you'll get a Liverpool crop up, you'll get a Man City, you'll get a dominant Man United. I guarantee you, in 7 or 8 years' time, when we are still endlessly talking about the perils of this football club, there'll be another superpower, possibly a Newcastle United, and we'll still be there and we'll still be irrelevant. And the quicker
you play, James Coleman will still be the starting right back in 7 or 8 years too.
Absolutely, we'll still be having the essential Tom Davis debate, which I promise you we will get to. But and do you know what, this might sound like an enormous overreaction. We've lost two games on the bounce. One of them was in apocalyptically bad fashion. I get it. The world is not falling apart, and I still hope that we'll have a good season. But it's. The reason we've gone to this place is that it's games like Watford on Saturday that make you realise that our identity and our personality as a football club will never leave us. And we will consistently try and shake that off. And Keith, to your question about why we are like this, I have no idea. Because I think most fans thought that when the kind of David Moyes era broke away, and I'm not necessarily just talking about him, but I'm bringing Bill Kenwright into that, which to an extent, obviously, his input has decreased. It's the classic, why do we never win at Anfield question? And we all assume that when Tony Abbott and Leon Osman and all of that clan of footballers, Phil Jagielka, to an extent, Leighton Baines, when we all moved on and broke away from the shackles of Everton meaning so much to everyone, that's when we'd start to rely on the quality of our football. That's when we'd start to break away from the curse and the voodoo that we seem to carry, not only in big games like the Derby, but just generally from season to season. And quite honestly, a lot of the apathy that I think most of us hold at the moment is because we are all simply just shrugging our shoulders on a weekly basis now. It's great when it goes well. But when we get round to this point again, where we're getting our arses handed to us by a really, really bad football team in Watford, none of us really have the care or the knowledge to know why it's happening anymore. And I know it's a dangerous place to go to on a podcast that attracts people who want to talk about Everton, but I think collectively this week, that this is all how we feel. And it's frustrating because we want to engage, we want to be successful, and I get that football fans of every single one of the Premier League teams has exactly the same feelings, but I think we're at that point now where we can no longer talk about a Burnley or a Leicester City or a West Ham United. We have nothing on them anymore. Nothing.
Right.
We won lots of trophies in the past, and do you know what? You've mentioned one of them, Keith: charity, heritage, history, everything that is away from that horrible green 100 yards of football turf that about this football club is absolutely wonderful. But when it comes down to the brass tacks of playing football, I don't really feel like we've got any form of pedigree now to say that we're better than the vast majority of the teams in the league.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, to be honest. How long can you talk about a football club's history for before it becomes irrelevant? I mean, we talk about teams like Newcastle, say, oh, look at Newcastle. Newcastle haven't won anything in 50 years or whatever, or 60. We haven't won anything in 35, but bar that FA Cup. And that's now, what, 26 years ago?
Yeah, 26
years ago. And we were
in the mid-90s. So how we managed to do that? I mean, that's what Everton's next trophy win looks like, isn't it? In the midst of being shite, we somehow to win three or four games in a row.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, Everton are... They're a conundrum, aren't they? They're a conundrum wrapped up in an enigma.
Only a conundrum if you're still trying to figure it out. And maybe that's the point, is that, just stop worrying. I joked about it before. Can we just be Fulham fans who just go to the game because it's just something to do? And hey, if they win, that's awesome. But what are you going to And by the way, can I just point this out too, that I know that there's definitely, and Mark, you said it before, like there's some of people who are listening to this thinking, my God, what a reaction to one game. I get that a loss is the same in the standings, in the table, if you lose 1-0 versus 5-2. But there was something so offensive about that loss. That I haven't felt that kind of and it wasn't just me. You guys picked up on it too, and it's weird because on the one hand, I don't like anyone criticizing anyone else's emotional reaction to it. I didn't listen to the post match just because I wanted to get as far away from Everton last weekend as I could.
Yeah.
I've heard that it turned into therapy via humor. And I think that's great. And I don't have any problem with anyone kind of processing the shit that is, that is a bad Everton result in the way that best suits them. But let's also be honest too. The reason people are having this reaction is because, I'm sorry, not every loss is the same. It might technically be, excuse me, but
yeah,
to lose to that team, and to do so in a way that basically took 20 plus years of Everton tropes, Everton that tropes and memes, and combined them into one shocking 20-minute period of football at Goodison in front of a full house. I felt like that was it felt offensive. The way we gave up the goals felt offensive, especially once we had gone behind. And I've said it before, but some of those players just absolutely quitting. That's what I can't handle. Okay, I've abandoned my expectations about winning things and about being elite anymore. And I will be told that I am too cynical. And why have a podcast about Everton if I don't think that we can compete for things? Well, we can't compete for things because we're not good enough to. We have a very poorly run football operation at our club, and therefore we are not in a position to compete for things. But what I can't let go of, and I hope this doesn't make me Everton da, but I can't let go of players quitting on the team, quitting on the manager. And frankly, there was something different about the performances. And believe me, I get that this is optics and this is context. When we were crapping the bed at home last season in front of zero fans, that sucked, but it was sort of like a suck in isolation or in a vacuum, if you will. But to do that in front of those fans, our fans, say what you want, and believe me, I'm certainly not saying that every one of our fans is pure as the Durban snow, but my God, there is a level of commitment and caring and love and devotion that these poor people have and endure, and yet to have that happen in front of them made it worse. Like, if this had happened away at Watford, I mean, the reaction would still be really bad, but I think there's something about it being at Goodison in front of a full house that just made it worse. And I think that's why we're having this reaction to it. Mm-hmm. I think that, yes, we are making one match into a referendum on all of, Everton fandom and what the point of this is and all of these things. I think that that's the thing that just sticks with me. It was the manner with which we lost, the context of it all. And I said after the match, and I do want your thoughts on this, I said after the match that if Benitez had all of this goodwill going for him headed into that game, even with the couple of losses we'd had this season, none of them felt humiliating. Mm-hmm. They all sort of felt like, well, sometimes shit happens, it's not your day, but we've been playing such a nice brand of competent football. The ugliness of that one loss seems to almost have undone all of the goodwill that he had. Now, I am not suggesting that we sack him, because the last thing that we need is more instability. I think Everton are just going to have to endure. They're just going to, the manager did not set us up well to win. The manager made bad substitutions. But the manager for me right now is about, what, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth in line in terms of the problems that we've got at the club right now. To me, it is all about squad construction, and it's all about a complete lack of overall character. Not every player is like this, by the way. There are some players with tremendous character. Unfortunately, many of them were missing last Saturday. But we have a lot of guys who are there to collect a paycheck, and they showed you who they were on Saturday. And if you're honest with yourselves, a lot of those same guys, and I don't even need to name names because we've named them before on this pod, and I think that you could go back and watch the third, fourth, fifth goal, and you watch which players were doing what. There are players that are absolutely at this club collecting a paycheck and doing little else. And they not only showed us who they were on Saturday, if you're really honest with yourself, they've been showing us who they are for a long time. And that is not easy when it comes to contracts. It's not easy to just kind of get rid of a player, as much as we talk about just bend them all. We can't do that. I understand that. But I'm sorry, the common denominator here has been a collection of players who consistently do, we can replace the manager over and over again, but we keep getting back to players quitting on the manager and quitting on Everton. But in this particular case, I feel like they were quitting on the fans right in front of their eyes. And to me, that was the most egregious part of what we saw Saturday, hence the reaction that you're seeing today.
Yeah, Rob, I think a lot of what you've said there takes me back to the summer when we were talking about how controversial it would be if Rafael Benitez come in, all of the plethora of names that we kind of threw about as being prospective Everton managers. And for all of the things that you've just said there, that's exactly why we were saying that whoever Everton appoints as manager doesn't really matter. Because yes, there'll be tactical nuances and there'll be certain players who they go after, but I think the rotten core that you've described there in terms of not only levels of character and just sheer inability, but I think the ability to totally throw it in at key moments is something that will follow this group of players around, regardless of who the manager is. And I think, Keith, at the weekend, that the difference, you know what, Everton lose games at Goodison, and they lose games that they really shouldn't do. But now and again, it goes to a really intangibly dark place. And you kind of get this really moody mist that sets over Goodison Park to the point where it's like a boiling war zone inside those four walls of Goodison Park. And I think back to 4-0 Bolton defeat at home, the sixes and sevens that Arsenal have put past us. And certainly that 5-2 against Watford on Saturday was right up there in terms of being just one of those really dangerous parts of Liverpool for about 15 minutes, because it was pretty nasty in terms of the feelings that were inside there. But I'm intrigued to see what your thoughts were on the reaction to Rafael Benitez at the time, because we've obviously mentioned him, and there'll be so much scrutiny about the tactical setup at the weekend, and in particular a couple of the substitutions that we'll come on to. But he's not the first Everton manager to make poor decisions and to make poor substitutions, and for those substitutions to be booed roundly by the crowd, and for it to go as wrong as it did. But were you surprised at the level of vitriol, for want of a better word, that was directed towards him, primarily at the Richarlison for Anthony Gordon substitution? Or is that the going rate of abuse for a performance, regardless of the manager and the history that he might bring in?
I mean, like I said, like you said there, managers have been booed for substitutions in the past. Pretty much every Everton manager I've ever watched has been booed for a substitution in some form or another. I don't think there was anything particularly like directed at Benitez that we haven't seen before in other managers. If we leave out my binary scale that we're not allowed to talk about, otherwise Matt gets upset. which I must point out is very tongue-in-cheek. But I don't know. I just feel like, I mean, he spent, like, there was a lot of opposition to him coming in. Yeah. And there was a lot of sort of worry about if he got off to a poor start, it would go downhill quickly. And then he came in and he sort of made Everton quite stable, and he built up a bit of goodwill with the fans. And all that seems to have just gone in 1 week. I mean, West Ham, like, nobody particularly got on his case for the West Ham game. We were just beaten by a better team on the day. We gave them a game. It wasn't a rout. We played all right. Well, we didn't play all right. They didn't play great. But we weren't battered or anything. We didn't look like in a different league or whatnot. But it seems to, like, all of the goodwill he's built up seems to have gone off the back of Saturday and what's happened.
Yeah.
I don't think the substitutions were great. Tactically, I think we were probably set up how we had to be, given key players missing. And for large parts, it did actually work. We looked direct. We went at them. We were unlucky with the equaliser came from a mistake, giving away a free kick in a dangerous position. But by and large, we looked like the better side. We were playing decent football. We were attacking. We were creating chances and stuff. And then he made the subs, and you could argue, yeah, okay, great. He brings Richarlison on, and Richarlison scores within minutes, and it looks great. But Richarlison's goal came from a cross from a centre half.
Yeah,
right. That's an anomaly. That's not going to happen every 5 minutes to create those chances. Your crosses are going to come in from your fast, direct attacking wingers, of which we had two on the park. We had Gray and we had Gordon, and he brought Gordon off. Don't know why he brought Gordon off, because he was having a very good game. One of his better games for Everton. He looked good on the ball. He looked exciting on the ball.
Well, Keith, he hasn't got 90 minutes in his legs, apparently, which quite for an attacking midfield player of his age, I think we've got some serious questions to ask.
What are they doing in training? Is he just sitting there eating chips or something?
Absolutely.
And talking about 90 minutes in the legs, let's talk about the 500-pound elephant up front.
Oh, well.
How did he how did he stay on the pitch for 90 minutes?
I think the point I made after the game, Keith, is that, first of all, that what you're talking about in terms of the manner of Everton's the goal that put us 2-1 ahead, is that there was no real plan. I couldn't really see how Everton's goal was going to come about. Yet we had some talented players on the pitch, but I think it was glaringly obvious throughout the whole game that without that central pivot and without that target man and that kind of pivotal point to our play up top that someone like a Dominic Calvert-Lewin will eternally give you, then it all fell apart very quickly. And for my money, if we were to get ourselves ahead like we did, I think we were relying on that sort of moment where we be it a set piece or an individual piece of skill from someone like a Richarlison to get us out of a pretty dire game. But Solomon Rondon, Joe, what people can make kind of really bad arguments for why he stayed on the pitch at the weekend. And I mean, you can turn yourself blue in the face about, you know, he was another presence up top and all the defenders are focusing on Rondon and his imperial threat, and that's why Richarlison was allowed the space in the box. And we can go down a really weird road of Davy Klassen's ghost run against Stoke City.
What a run that was, though.
Quite frankly, his performance at the weekend had gone way beyond the threshold of being able to stay on that football pitch. And it was at the point whereby I don't think Benitez could have argued for a tactical reason to make any other substitution other than taking him off. Because I know that we speak so often about it's like playing with 10 men, it's like playing with 9 men, etc. But it was genuinely like we were hindering ourselves by having that man on the football pitch. And you know, the most frustrating element for me, Rob, is that every time we've played against Solomon Rondon at Goodison Park, he's absolutely torn us apart. And when the ball gets played into him, he looks solid. He looks like he's capable of holding the ball up. He looks like he's capable of causing problems to our back line, which, having seen them on Saturday, is no great feat. But there's only so long, surely, that we can consistently watch this fella and say, well, he's been out of the top level for a while. He's gaining fitness. For my money, when we had an international break, 2 weeks ago, for a fortnight, any good standing professional footballer is capable of getting himself to the top level in that time, because that is quite simply what we pay you hundreds of thousands of pounds to do. But I honestly think not only on Saturday, but going forward, his inclusion for me now is beyond repairable in terms of how we make this work with him in the squad. And I get that there's limitations to this team, and I get that there's massive contributing factors in terms of simply not having the numbers to deal with the level of problems that we've got at the moment. But surely, Rob, surely Rafael Benitez is seeing what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah. I struggle with questions about you're saying something that sounds very obvious, but how many times have we said, surely the manager is seeing what everyone else is seeing, what is plain to the eye? And there is something about becoming Everton manager that seems to oftentimes make them blind to some very basic truths that are right in front of their eyes. Now, Yeah, well, but, you know, here's the thing about Solomon Rondon. Like, I think there's a few elements to this. One, do I think that he is not giving a total effort? No, I don't tend to think that's the issue. By all accounts, Solomon Rondon has been, for his entire career, a hard worker, a high character guy, good in the dressing room. You know, like, I never really had a major issue with that aspect of signing him. What he doesn't possess anymore is footballing ability. And that is because he has so many miles on that odometer. You know what I mean? Like there are some players who at a certain point, especially those who have plied their trade by being incredibly physical, strong guys who take a lot of contact physically as a core part of their game. I just think that he may have run out of that juice. And Rafa Benitez kind of has to own this decision, and he is owning this decision, and maybe that's why he kept playing him. But he owns this decision because it was clearly his choice to sign him. And you can say, well, it was a free, and you know, sometimes you're just kind of taking a punt there, and I understand that. But you know, Solomon Rondon is ultimately the result not only of the choice to sign Solomon Rondon, but is also tied to an entire series of bad choices that Everton made when it came to constructing a squad, when it came to trying to fortify that position. I don't know what Keith is doing in the background, by the way, Mark. I think he is putting together furniture or something like that. Oh, there he is. Okay, sorry, Keith. You're very loud in the background. I'm going to send you a help article on how to press mute on your mic next time. So that way, you know, I think Solomon Rondon is the result of a series of bad decisions related to the overall poor construction of this squad. And, you know, whether that is the decisions made around Moise Keane, whether that was, frankly, as we saw, the decisions around players like Josh King. We made a lot of bad choices. We also chose, by the way, to play ball with Richarlison this summer and say to him, yeah, go ahead and play in the Olympics. And again, I don't know that, you know, I know that he was the subject of a horror tackle against Burnley, but I also think that it probably didn't help anything, that he's probably more susceptible to injury, just like we see with these players who get absolutely abused by their own countries. And we, you know, we kind of allow it to happen. And so there's a lot of things that go into that, but you're right. I don't know why Gordon came off instead of Rondon. I know it was the right decision to put Richarlison on, but the bottom line is this: taking off Anthony Gordon, and I like Anthony Gordon. We talked on here about the idea of giving, you know, young players like him a real role to let them develop so we have answers about them, you know. But that single decision, I'm sorry, does not account for, you know, why we shipped those goals. That is down to our midfield. That is down to our back line, which was absolutely comically atrocious last week. And so I think it is fair to say that Rafa Benitez did not do nearly enough in his decisions about whether it be the starting 11 or the substitutions to help things. But I don't think that that's the same as saying that he is primarily at fault for the way we played at the end of the game on Saturday. Now, I also do subscribe to the notion, by the way, that this is a bottom line business and that the quote buck stops here with the manager. So the manager is ultimately responsible on some level for performances. So Benitez gets the same black mark for this game that a lot of these players do. But he would probably and rightly say, like, what would you have me do in some of these scenarios? I get that, like, right now he has to really thread a needle through such a narrow, he has to narrowly thread all these needles because he doesn't have any squad flexibility at all. And so all it takes is one bad decision to just make this whole house of cards fall down, maybe. But the bottom line is that this is still down to those who've made decisions about players. He is one of them, yes. But to me, Rondon is, yes, a problem because he just can't play anymore. But the real problem is that Dominic Calvert-Lewin got injured and has been completely unavailable for most of the season. And for whatever reason, and I don't know why this is beginning to feel like a real trend at Everton, I think that injuries are a result of both bad fortune and things that are just completely uncontrollable. But we do seem to have a real trend over the last several years of lots of soft tissue injuries, lots of players who, while they're rehabbing, somehow suffer a colossal setback. Like, what happened to Jean-Philippe Gbamin to me is partly luck, and I think it's partly mismanagement. I think that Calvert-Lewin, a penny for his thoughts. I would love to know what he thinks about why he is injured again, how he could have gotten injured again so badly that we're talking about him being out through all of December. Like, there's failure has a lot of authors, Mark. You know, I mean, and Everton have lots of authors working on that failure right now. And so to pinpoint any one managerial decision, I think I think it underestimates the sheer scale of the failure that we're looking at in terms of the club. Now, if we can pivot for a second, Mark, you know, the opportunity comes on Monday to kind of right the ship. I don't know if Everton can do that. I don't think Wolves are any kind of world beaters, but they're better than Watford, and Watford are the worst team in the league, and we saw what just happened. So we probably have to dispense with this notion that any side is a very favorable matchup for us right now. And frankly, we just have to have some kind of response and some kind of result. It's going to be hard, and you can't really ask any of us to have a lot of faith in us getting a result. But the season is going to continue regardless of how we felt about last Saturday. And so we must go into it again. We must go into the breach once more. So, I mean, that's kind of where we're at right now. I just don't think that there are a lot of solutions coming until the window opens in January. And even then, as I've said several times, I am still very skeptical about our willingness to go into the market in January, and B, our ability, if we decide to go into the market, to actually make good deals and to acquire good players that will actually help solve some of these issues. So, you know, I guess we'll see where it goes from there.
Well, Rob, you mentioned the build-up to Monday's game at Molineux, hand-in-hand with the fact that Everton need to find solutions. And one man who's been spoken about today as we record is Tyler Onyango, in terms of being involved in Everton's first team setup, and obviously rather crucially in the area of the pitch that I think, if we all honestly look at it at the weekend, is the area of the pitch that this game really got away from us. We talk about managers making decisions, and do you know what? It will always come down to substitutions, because they're the on-trend pivotal things that you can talk about in a post-match podcast or in the days that follow it. But I think the one thing we knew about losing someone like Abdoulaye Doucouré was that the setup of this team had to change, purely because we have no one of the stature and the quality that he offers us. And I think that the most disappointing element of the weekend for me was the sheer naivety to think that, A, someone like Tom Davies could come in and do an equivalent role. Also, hand in hand with that, the fact that I think we honestly, obviously, with the benefit of hindsight now, after Saturday, we know that Alan is simply not the footballer that we need him to be if Abdoulaye Doucouré is there. And you can talk long and hard about him personally and about how that should not be the case. But all that said, we go into this game on Monday at Molineux. I would like to think that we've seen enough of that too in midfield to know that that is quite simply not resilient enough to work at this level. Are you expecting a different setup in terms of playing potentially a flatter three that we thought that we'd see? Is that why someone like Onyango is getting mentioned? And just to finish that entire question off, why on earth did we not see Jean-Philippe Gbamin at the weekend? Because if that is not the time to bring on your £20 million holding midfielder, regardless of what has gone before him in the 2 years previous, surely there is a point in that game where you think that he is the absolute answer. And if he's not, Rob, is he fit to be sitting on that substitute bench?
Well, I mean, he might be on the bench because we just don't have we have to make up the numbers. I mean, there's a reason we've got two keepers on the bench every week too. I'd like to see Gbamin, but how many times do we hear this? Well, you know, we're not in training every week. We don't see what the manager sees or whatever. I swear to God, that old Easter egg is never going to get old. I don't know what to make of it. I think that on the one hand, I'm encouraged by the fact that, or at least by the idea that he might do something very outside of the box, which is take an 18-year-old with barely any Premier League experience or first team experience whatsoever and say, all right, we've got to, you know, ideally in a functioning, healthy club, you wouldn't have an 18-year-old like him jumping right into the fire like this. But I don't want to be critical of that because, as I say all the time, I think that the biggest handicap or self-imposed handicap that so many managers have in the Premier League and in modern football is their own enslavement to preconceived conventional, you know, notions of conventional wisdom of, well, you don't, you know, you just got to play these guys. It doesn't matter how many times it fails. They're the veteran players. You got to play them. Like, I would like to think that he saw what we all saw on Saturday and said, you know, I'm not going to keep doing this for four games to see if it gets better, because it's not. I think we have enough. And we talked about this when we talked about Anthony Gordon, Mark, like, we have enough tape on Tom Davis by now to know what he is. And hey, he scored a goal, so, you know, that was nice. But I would say that we kind of know what he is. And so I am all for unconventional solutions to problems that are of a, you know, or that are somewhat unconventional right now. And so Tyler Onyango is, I think, at least the idea, at least what I've read, and I won't pretend I've seen a ton of him to know this, but that he is of a more similar ilk in terms of the playing style and maybe the bigger frame, if you will, of a Doucouré. Maybe that's the thinking, is that he's someone who can provide a little bit more, you know, stability on the ball. He's going to be someone who's got a little more pace. Maybe that's the idea. I don't really know. But I would say that if you're going to go with a flat three in the midfield, I think that part of what this manager is up against is a lot of imperfect solutions. And so therefore, you have to sort of be willing to take a risk here and there. You know, I would like to see Gabam in play, but if he's not playing for some reason, and it's weird because during the preseason, we saw him look pretty decent. I don't know if it's just they are just trying to, you know, they just don't feel comfortable playing him heavy minutes right now. And you generally aren't putting another holding midfielder into a game as a sub, especially when you're down or you're, you know, level in the game. So maybe there just hasn't been an opportunity. But, you know, Tom Davis probably got the nod ahead of Gabamin because Gabamin, you know, Davis was seen as someone who, while underwhelming and not someone the manager really rates, clearly is someone that he felt like was fit and could just step in and just do a job or whatever. Well, you know, it didn't really work out. If you go with three, the question becomes who are your three? You know, with no Doucouré, you have Allen there. Okay. And then what else? I mean, Gomes is still recovering. He seems to be indicating on his social media that he's getting closer. But we've seen that movie before, right, Mark, of having a good, you know, now Gomes does play better. I will say Gomes plays significantly better in a three-man midfield than he ever does in a two. So I think that Gomes, who is more skilled when he gets forward, you could play him, Allen. And to me, I still look at Gabamin as being a better idea to play there than Davis. You could put Onyango in there, I guess. I feel like what we're more likely to see is Onyango on the bench and someone that he could go to. But I'd be kind of shocked if he's starting an 18-year-old and who just himself came off a pretty significant injury in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it's sort of like, if you're afraid of Gabamin's fitness, then wouldn't you be kind of afraid of someone who's just even more recently come off of a long-term mm-hmm. injury, who's also 18 years old, who you're not paying an incredible amount of money? Like, I'd rather them just take the shrink wrap off Gabamin and let me see that he's awful so that we can at least say, well, I mean, at least we have the answer. Gabamin's just not the same as he used to be and whatever. But I'm really struggling with what to do about that midfield, and therefore I can imagine so is the manager.
How dare you overlook Gabamin's 7 out of 10 45 minutes away at Huddersfield in the Carabao Cup?
He was good. I thought he was perfectly serviceable there. Like, you're right. Like, what's the fear? But maybe the bigger question mark is, what's the upside of playing Tom Davis there again? Whereas with Gabamin, at least on paper, in theory, has a higher upside, right?
Yeah. And in the same breath, you've got, what's the downside? And do you know what? No one's sitting here saying, let's aimlessly throw Tyler Onyango into the starting lineup on Monday like a lamb to the slaughter, and he'll just join the ever-growing bonfire of Everton midfielders that absolutely tank it at the top level. We're not saying that, but there surely comes a point where you think, well, if we're not going to be good and we're not going to be successful, why don't we learn something while we're doing it?
Yes. So
we can look at Tyler Onyango. We can look at someone like Lewis Dobbin. I will echo everything you've said in terms of I've seen Lewis Dobbin kick an actual football in person about 7 times. I'm not going to sit here and say that he is the answer to everything, but how are we ever going to know these things? I can't watch Tom Davis play another 100 games for Everton while we're all still trying to figure out what is going on here. And you know, I am not singling this lad out like I have admittedly done in the past, because I don't feel like he's at the calibre of midfielder and the calibre of footballer that we need to take this thing anywhere near where we all want to go. But surely we've all learnt enough now. This Onyango thing, it feels a little bit Benny Beningame from a few years ago, where we knew that we were collectively terrible. We were going away to Chelsea, who, by the way, we've got to play alongside Tottenham, Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea, Leicester, Man City, all before Christmas. This is not the time to get a little bit more solid in the midfield and also find out something about a player who, yes, admittedly, has just come back from a long-term injury, but it's someone who we hope is going to be able to be a central pillar in this football team for years going forward. And I think Tom Davis is the unfortunate ideal summary to use in this kind of hamster wheel that is Everton, in terms of we never seem to learn the lessons of individual players. We never seem to learn the lessons of being 2-1 up against a terrible football team with 13 minutes left. We're on this constant cycle of disappointment. And I think he is the unfortunate personification of that. And Joe, we've spoken so many times this season about watching highlights back and, you know, watching fabulous Abdoulaye Doucouré goals back. And unfortunately, the only clip I've seen back of the weekend, Rob, is that shit show leading up to, oh, don't quote me on which one it was, one of Watford's goals where both of our central destructive midfielders bottle out of tackles before our captain kind of dances around Watford's left winger, who proceeds to put the ball in the back of our net. I mean, if Rafael Benitez is not watching that segment of play thinking that something massively drastic has to happen in the next 4 days, then I think we might as well just call it a day right now.
Yeah, well, I feel for anyone having to make some of these decisions, but, you know, I think about it this way too. Like, if you know, if you're going to finish like what we are probably going to finish this season, which is mid-table, and granted, I picked 12th and maybe we don't finish that low, but it wouldn't shock me really. But I would rather finish 12th and learn something about players that we've got and or develop players that we've got. Like the struggles that someone like if you wanted my best argument for throwing Onyango into the fire, beyond what I always say, which is that young players are treated way too preciously in this sport as if playing them is going to hurt them somehow. Like, just let them play, let them struggle. That struggle is sort of like the tougher skin you build after a wound heals, you know? And I think that I'm of the opinion that if you wanted to make a strong argument about Onyango, it's that I would rather see Onyango get those minutes that Tom Davis or that a Fabian Delph would get, you know, or some spare like that. I'd rather see him get those minutes, even if it meant a short-term setback, because really the difference between finishing 10th and 12th or 9th and 11th. Like, who gives a shit? It doesn't really matter. It's not really consequential in any significant way. So for me, I think it would be better for us to learn something and or be developing something as opposed to just like playing guys just because they, you know, that there's this conventional wisdom about, well, you got to play the guys who've been there before. Well, the problem is we've been there before with these guys and we've seen them play and we know what we're going to get. Mm-hmm. I am all about the unknown and seeing what's in the mystery box and seeing what's behind door number three. You know what I mean? Like I would rather see that kind of approach. And the fact that Tyler Onyango has been elevated into this discussion by being brought into first team training by Rafa Benitez, you can view it as a desperate move, but you can also view it as a manager who, to the point we were talking about before, is acknowledging that he has seen in one game enough to know what doesn't work and is going to at least consider something different. Mm. Now, the proof will be in what the actual squad looks like and the starting 11 looks like on Monday. But I'm at least encouraged by the fact that there doesn't seem to be this sort of thing like we got with Carlo, which was that, you know, it doesn't matter how many times we failed the same group. He was going to pretty much put the same general group out there every time. And so I'd like to think that maybe we'll see something there. And again, it doesn't have to be on Yango, but I love the guy. I think he's a cool guy. I think his Instagram's great, and I think that it's great that he's from Liverpool or whatever. But I don't know how many times, how many years we have to have the same conversation anymore about Tom Davis is what he is. He's a squad. He's not a bad player. He's just not a good player, and he's just not someone that I need to see more of, or that really adds to any real solution set. I think you just at a certain point have to say, all right, I know what we've got in Tom Davis. He can come do a job if we need to, but this is an opportunity right now while DeCore is out to look for, you know, better high upside solutions. And I guess I'd like to see that. And to kind of wrap that up into a bow about our larger conversation, Mark, I think that when you are a club mired in mediocrity, which we have been for a long time, you have to be willing, especially, and we talked about Benitez's, I think we praised him for this early on in the season. You know, you take a guy like that who doesn't focus on what he doesn't have. He just says, all right, here's what I've got. And I've got to make chicken salad sandwich out of chicken shit here. You know, like it's the old, like, you know, he's got to find a way to make something good out of it. And he's done that for the most part, still, you know, the Watford result aside, the body of work overall, at least at this point, is still pretty decent given all of the injuries, given the squad he's got to work with. But I think that is only part of what needs to be a larger, broader level of thinking that says at Everton, we can't compete with the big clubs on conventional terms. We don't have the money. You know, it's funny because we talk about having money now compared to Moyes. Yeah, we have money compared to like before Farhad Moshiri. But when you compare us now to the richest of the rich clubs in the league, it's not like we're pretty much kind of back to where we were at. You know, it's just we may have more money, but so do they. They have considerably more money. And so I think that Everton have to embrace the weird. They have to embrace a willingness to say, we have to find advantages in places where people are not looking for them. We have to take risks and say, you know, it might be a little early to put this guy into the first team. It might be a little strange to play this guy in this situation or whatever, but we would rather have a chance at spectacularly succeeding as opposed to knowing we're going to fail with the same approach and the same way of doing things, because to me there's no downside, you know, beyond relegation, which I just frankly don't subscribe to the idea that we're really a threat of that. I think Everton have an opportunity, and I don't know how many times I've said this before, but they have an opportunity to get weird with it. They have an opportunity to make some unconventional decisions, play some young players, in spots when there are injuries that have provided that opportunity. Why not do it? There's just no point other than if you want to say, well, we're paying them good money, which, hey, that's an argument. There's no point to seeing Delph anymore. There's no point to seeing Davis anymore. There's a part of me that thinks there's no point in seeing Michael Keane anymore. I've seen enough of him, frankly, after last week. Like there are, and I've seen enough of Mason Holgate. Like you can say all of those things, but in certain, some positions you don't actually have a viable alternative. And in some positions you do. And so I think that Everton have to kind of embrace a strategy of being a little bold. It may come with risks, but the bigger risk to me is just doing the same old things and getting the same old results and perpetuating this mediocrity, on a terminal basis.
Well, you know what, Rob, you've used the term there. I was just going to say, there's a freedom to mediocrity, isn't there? That's the leash that is not around Everton's neck at the moment, because
there's an opportunity with mediocrity. For sure.
There's no expectation. Obviously, there's no, unless we go on a horrendous run, and this will no doubt get dragged up again in May, but there's no real prospect of us getting dragged into any form of really deathly battles in this Premier League this season. And quite simply, the unfortunate truth with regards to both Onyango and Davis to an extent is that footballers of their age are expected to perform way earlier than they ever have been in the past. No one, I know we look at someone like a Tyler Onyango. Again, I reiterate that we know absolutely nothing about how much pedigree this lad is going to have at the top level, but we also probably didn't know that about Bukayo Saka and about Mason Greenwood a year ago, who have only very recently turned 20 themselves. I get it, there's a little bit more in terms of age about them, and they're a little bit more sheltered in terms of the nature of the club that they're at, and they can be nursed into the realities of football a little bit slower than someone like Tyler Onyango will no doubt be nursed in when he puts one bad pass out of play at Molineux on Monday. But we need to learn these lessons, and we need to find out. And if ever there was a football team who looked like it needed to learn some real lessons about itself, I think we most definitely saw that on Saturday. Rob, one last final.
Can I ask you, can I make one? Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. One last point I wanted to make on that. And when it comes to this discussion about what does it look like to play, to give an opportunity, like we talked about this with Gordon, like when Richarlison was hurt, Calvert-Lewin was hurt, you had all these injuries everywhere. We said, you might as well play Gordon so that you can learn something about him, like, and you can see him develop and see what do Gordon's talents look like within the framework of playing with other first team players, because you don't really at a certain point learn anything about Tyler Onyango or Anthony Gordon playing with other under 23s, right? Like, yeah. I would like to see, if you wanted to make, again, to strengthen this argument that we're both making here, I'd like to see what Tyler Onyango can learn from playing next to Allen. I'd like to see what he can learn when he's in a position to have to try to make plays and connect the dots between our defense, with good play, with players like Richarlison or with Calvert-Lewin eventually. Like, I don't need Tyler Onyango, frankly, given where he's elevated to at this point. I don't know that, just like we talked about, there's not much more to learn about Tom Davis, playing in the first team for Everton. Conversely, I don't think there's much more to learn about Tyler Onyango and Anthony Gordon playing for the under 23s either. So to me, you either play them with the first team or you send them out on loan where they're going to do so. But right now, there's no window opening until January. Now's the time to just go ahead and take advantage of this opportunity to say, what would it look like to see what would Tyler Onyango's talent look like playing with better players. And that's what I would like to see happen. I don't know that it will, but it's just, again, it may not be about Onyango in particular, but it's about an approach that says, Young players develop better playing with better players. That's part of the reason why at clubs, you know, at some of the clubs like Chelsea or at City. Now, again, the reasons for their ability to have these young players excel have to do with the fact that they can throw a young player in and it won't really affect their bottom line because they're surrounded by, you know, the most expensive squads in the world, which I grant you. Yeah. But I would also make the argument that the reason why young players why does a Phil Foden who is homegrown at City since he was a kid, why does he become a superstar? Well, part of it is because, of course, he's got talent, right? But I think part of it also is that he has honed that craft and honed that talent playing with other super talented players. Mm-hmm. So to me, you know, you could, if you had Phil Foden at Everton and he was the same, you know, player in terms of his actual raw talent, but he just kept playing with the under 23s because of the conventional wisdom of, well, he's young, he's not ready or whatever. Like you're putting a cap on the outcome there. And so for me, I want to see I'm not saying throw every under 23 into the first team, but I am saying that when the opportunity presents itself because of injury or what, you know, whatever the freak occurrence may be, or in our case, just, you know, astounding mediocrity in certain positions in terms of the squad depth, then play these guys and see what happens. I would rather bet on that outcome than the outcome that we're going to get by doing the same old thing and expecting a different result.
You know, Rob, the other dark way of looking at the whole, you know, we could go into a whole different podcast about what Everton do with their under 23 setup, but if we find out in the next year that Anthony Gordon is absolutely not the footballer that we need him to be, or Tyler Onyango or Lewis Dobbin or any one of these names, the prospect of giving them opportunities at the top level and finding out those things means that if it is pretty negative and you don't think that the caliber of footballer that you need is there, then go and make a business decision to move them on for a financial profit, as opposed to letting someone like Matty Pennington lead the 23s out when he's 35. It's it's that kind of broken system that we've got, whereby with these players, unfortunately, there comes a point where you have to use them or lose them. And Everton just kind of sit in that cloud of just nothing, where we expect that one day they'll turn into training. We'll put them in the first team and it might just click and work. It feels as though it takes us a lot longer to learn lessons about our own footballers than other teams do.
Well, most players in every sport, Mark, who are young, it is in a very narrow set of circumstances or instances where a young player just suddenly, you know, is inserted into a lineup and is just a star from the beginning. Yeah. Most of them go through struggle, and that struggle is what makes them into, you know, it's the iron sharpens iron, but really it's just the, you know, like on one level you hear that term, but I think that a better way of saying it is just that struggle begets future success, especially for a young player. They have to understand what works and what doesn't work so that they can understand what the best version of themselves as a footballer looks like. And so therefore, I think at a certain point, you just have to allow for a player to go out there and say, we may have some short-term setback with a result here or there, or with the player not playing well here or there, but if they're good enough, they eventually come good. And I don't mean eventually like 100 games, 200 games in or whatever, but I do mean that, you know, give a young player a full, you know, a full couple of seasons worth of, but, you know, combined appearances and starts.
Yeah.
And suddenly you start seeing a player who is able to take their talents and raise their game, because that's what ultimately being a skilled professional is about, that they have to find a way to utilize their talents to raise their level up to where it needs to be to compete. If you don't allow them to do that, or if you think, well, I'm going to wait till they get really great at the 23s and then then start that process all over again in the first team. I mean, by then, you know, you've already missed out. By then, they're leaving for Southampton. You know, by then they're saying, I've had enough of waiting here. I want to go somewhere where I'm going to be allowed to make mistakes in order to be able to take steps forward. This boogeyman of like the, oh, well, we can't play young players because we're competing for Europe. We're not competing for Europe. This Everton side is not competing for Europe, and we are not threatened by relegation. So to me, that means there is a tremendous opportunity that needs to be seized, and I'd like to see it seized as quickly as possible. And by the way, I would also throw in there that I could talk about this not only in midfield where we focused on, give me more of Branthwaite. I'd rather see Branthwaite struggle a little bit to see his top side as we began to see some of the upside of playing him when we had to play him versus seeing more of Mason Holgate and Michael Keane, frankly. Yeah. If we had any fullback options, we would be having that discussion, but we don't. We don't really have striking options. But in the areas of the pitch where we do have some of these opportunities, there's going to come a point where the difference between playing them or not playing them is going to be very minimal in terms of actual points, but it's going to be massive in terms of the long-term consequence of not knowing what those players can and cannot do.
Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no certainty about the next 7 days in Tyler Onyango's life, but I think the one thing we can safely say is whether he turns out for Everton or Everton under 23s, he'll still be playing in front of more people than James Rodriguez was the other night. that was particularly pleasing to watch, Rob, wasn't it?
Mark, that tweet that you put out was, which I retweeted, that was so great. And it was...
The body language was just horrible to watch, wasn't it?
Especially with like all five people in the stands watching one of the lowest levels of professional football in the world. Yeah, it was... Boy, how sad was that? Mark, before we go, I want to finish on something because this is going to be the last time I get to do this before Halloween this Sunday. But I want to make my kind of scary TV movie watching recommendation. Patty and I started talking about it last week, and I want to finish it off. I jokingly referred to it at the very beginning, but if you have a chance to see Midnight Mass on Netflix, it's incredible. It is – I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say it's definitely – it's a story that does ponder the deep meaning of life and death, but also is still a very scary monster story at the same time. And I highly recommend that. In terms of movies, I do also want to recommend this random indie horror flick that came out, I want to say this year or last year, but I saw it on Amazon Prime. I saw this a few weeks ago, and it's called Superhost. And it's about these two Instagram influencer types who basically have made a living by going to all of these different like home, private home rentals, like we use Airbnb type of thing or whatever. And what they do is they use that to like do these videos and all these different things to kind of, make money and peddle their influence or whatever. Well, they end up going to this one, to this one house that a woman is hosting them at. I say woman, like she's a very young woman, probably like in her early 20s or whatever, who seems very enthusiastic about them being there and is super excited about the whole proposition. But then it turns out that she is a psychotic killer, and and it turns into just an incredible shit show. But it's also awesome because it is very biting of the whole Instagram video culture and how fake all of it is. It's really, really good. It's called Superhost, and I cannot recommend it enough. That is the end of my scary movie and TV bit for the for this year. I hope every one of you has a happy Halloween, and for those of you who are out trick-or-treating and getting candy, please eat several pounds of chocolate for me.
Are we gonna get 6 weeks of Christmas film breakdown in the lead up to late December?
No, we're just gonna talk about our we're gonna talk about a different Die Hard moment every week, starting next week for the next 2 months.
None of this jog horror film nonsense that everyone's private messaging me about, but we're going to get into some serious stuff. But Rob, obviously, Halloween is basically like triple Christmas for you guys over there. So tell me you've got massive plans this weekend.
Oh, God. Well, no, I can't say that I do. I am going to I'm going to a college football game this Saturday because of a work thing for my that is tied to my wife. But I'm going to see what ought to be a probably not a very good game, but at least it'll be a major college football game between Oklahoma State and Kansas. That'll be interesting. But it's this tradition called homecoming, which is a very American thing here. That high schools and college and universities have, which is basically a big excuse to have like a party every year centered around a football game that invites, former students back to campus to be part of like festivities. And in the case of many of them, like parades and flowers and music and, food and merriment and all that kind of crap. But I'm going to be doing that this Saturday. And, but for Sunday, I think my wife and I'll be watching the Cowboys game on Thanksgiving, on Halloween night, and entertaining trick-or-treaters. I've got to go out and actually get good candy. We've had a supply chain issue over here in America, and so I feel like candy is really expensive right now, but we're going to get candy. And that's basically it. Yeah, I did pull out a photo from a couple years ago. I dressed up as Michael Myers for Halloween, not the Austin Powers Michael Myers, but the Michael Myers of Halloween fame. And it's a picture of me and my wife dressed up as Jamie Lee Curtis's character in that film. And so there's a picture of me with a knife looking like I'm about to stab my wife that I worry is going to be used against me in a court of law at some point. But luckily I have a mask on, so there's some plausible deniability there.
Maybe we can start homecoming as a thing over here when we get you over in December. That to me is the epitome of a man's homecoming, surely. When you're sitting there on the 2nd of January, Rob, watching Everton get absolutely spanked around the park by Leandro Trossard, that is the that is the quintessential meaning of homecoming for me.
I'm going to be there when all of Brighton's XG starts to turn into G right in front of my eyes, and Mick Greenall will be giving me the bird and saying, yeah, I told you, Rob, I told you that Brighton knew what they were doing. As we get closer to my trip, so I'm coming at the end of December, we'll actually talk about some of that on Kickabout, because I do get a lot of questions from American listeners on this about like what it's like to try to plan a trip out there and what the experience is like and what you need to know going there. And I say all the time to them, like, just ask anyone on Twitter. They're willing to tell you, because there's really no more like friendly city to visit in terms of people telling you what to see. And believe it or not, by the way, guys, there's a lot more to do in Liverpool than just go to Beatles museums. So I highly recommend you explore that as much as possible. But we'll talk about some of that. And Mark and I have been talking about, I'm going to throw this out for everyone. I know we're now into our 95th minute right now, which I know is making Matt Jones really happy. But
I think Watford is about to score their fifth here.
Yeah, exactly. I think that Mark and I have been talking about doing doing a recording of Kickabout somewhere in the city, where if you want to sit and have a pint while you watch us shoot the shit while we sit there and have pints, I think that we're looking into something like that. So if you have made it this far into the podcast and this is an idea that excites you, please say so on Twitter so that I can pass that along to some of these skeptical brethren I have at the Blue Room who don't think anything like this can work. But I do think it could work. I think it would be a lot of fun, and look forward to seeing as many of you out as I can when I'm over in December.
Yeah, absolutely. Rob, I think you've had the joy of being able to connect with so many Blues over here on the internet and in your previous trips when you've been over. But yeah, we're definitely going to look to get not only obviously everyone who contributes to our show, but all of you guys as the listeners as well. So it's going to be a bit of a mega party, I think. And I think I can definitely foresee a situation now whereby we're in a room that holds 100 and Rob's got about 400 Blues who want to come and see him. But we'll figure it out. But yeah, that's us. I hope we don't have to go to some of the places, Rob, on Kickabout that we've had to go to this week, but this is part and parcel of the life that we lead. Thanks very much for joining myself and Rob, and for Keith for joining us as well. Kickabout is, of course, just one of a number of shows that Blue Room graces your podcast feeds with this week. So we've got Subs Weekly, which Matt, Adam and Alan have recorded this week. Monday Show with Ben and Gavin Buckland and David Mooney is out as well. Obviously, feel free to go back and listen to that absolute barrage of hilarity, which was the post-match on Saturday. And obviously, we've got all of your build-up to Monday night's game at Molineux, whereby I regret to inform you all, we are going to have to sit around and watch and talk about Everton again. But until then, enjoy your weekend, and thanks very much for listening.
At Baker's, we work with local farms right in our own backyard to bring you food that's fresher than fresh. From homegrown watermelon that makes your mouth water to crisp corn picked right around the corner. Come pick out some yourself, because shopping for local produce should be as easy as shopping at your local Baker's. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
When you're a Boost member, you get free delivery, double fuel points, and lots more. Sign up at bakersplus.com/boost. Podcast Network.